Hello, and you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alex DeBoer. Sorry, we're just getting started here. Democracy Watch is the News Collective's weekly news report bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
I'm Lyndon Wong. It's Thursday, February 21st at 5:02 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hungarian-speaking Musqueam people.
At the beginning of February, the city made public data available on the individual ballots cast during our 2018 municipal election.
Local data analysis and census mapper Jens von Bergman graphed those votes cast for mayor and city council to try to get a sense of whether people used all 11 of their votes for council, whether voters voted exclusively for one party or a particular combination of parties, how many people voted only for independent candidates, and as well as other interesting voting patterns.
After that, we're going to turn to last night's City Hall public hearing, which is currently still underway as we speak. This hearing was on a redevelopment application to build a mixed-use housing and addictions care complex on a block of land between Clark and McLean's Drive along East First Avenue, which is near the East Van Cross, for those of you who could use a landmark to figure out that address. So according to an article, so there is a public hearing happening and it's still going on right now. So we're going to hear from some folks who spoke last night.
So reporters Alex DeBoer and our newest News Collective member, Binza Qureshi, spoke with folks from the Grandview Woodland Area Council, the Vancouver Tenants Union, the Carnegie Community Action Plan, as well as others who came to City Hall to speak on the development. We'll hear what they have to say after our first story. So let's go into our first interview with Jens von Bergman on what Vancouver's individual ballot data teaches us about our 2018 municipal election.
I have a company called Mountain Math that does data analysis, visualization, data plumbing.
As you know, I just wanted to talk to you about a blog entry you wrote and some graphs you made on the individual ballot data that was made available quite recently on Vancouver's 2018 municipal election. So I wanted to maybe just go through what you wrote and what you observed and discuss it just as an overview, first of all. So just to start out, could you tell me if most people who voted in the municipal election used all their votes?
Yes. So most people did use all their votes. Oh, well, about half, I should say, used all their votes for mayor and council. So only looked at the mayor and council part, not at park board or school board.
Right.
Just for those, about half it was that used all their votes, a little over half. And the others just stopped short. Maybe used only, so you had 11 votes for mayor and council, one for mayor and 10 for council, and the others used anywhere between really 1 to 10 of the 11 that they had.
And then which parties received a lot of block voting, meaning people who voted only for that party?
So the NPA was the one that really got the most. So roughly, if I look in here, maybe 13,000 votes, 13,000 ballots were only NPA votes. So that means that they really only had 9 total votes. There were 8 council candidates for NPA and then the mayoral candidate. So in some sense, the NPA really had an advantage of capturing sort of the full slate ballots just because people didn't waste too many votes. There were only 2 votes that they didn't use in that setup. Next up were the Greens, with about 3,000 people that just voted Greens and nothing else. And it sort of went down from there. 2,500 was Coalition Vancouver. Then less than that was COPE, Yes Vancouver, One City, Vision, and Pro Vancouver with just a couple hundred.
Right. And what about voting blocks that we saw, meaning people who voted only for like 2 or 3 parties?
Yeah. So some people just decided that, you know, they would mix things. I kind of threw in independents as another party. There were a lot of candidates. Most of the candidates weren't affiliated with the party. So if one counts those two, then really if we only look about what were the top combinations that people voted for, and NPA is sort of just NPA was really a lot. But then you also got people that voted basically through the board, COPE, Greens, Independent, One City Vision. So that was sort of the second biggest block if you look in terms of votes.
Right.
Then it goes down quite a bit after that. You get independent and NPA or just independents. Then you get blocks like more of the left-leaning COPE, Greens, Independent, One City, but without Vision. You get Coalition Vancouver, Independents, NPA, and sort of you get a whole bunch of mixes there.
Okay, yeah. I thought it was really interesting that some people only voted for independents since they're independent.
Right. No, I think that was kind of what part of the election was about too, the fact that there were a lot of independent candidates that they felt comfortable running as independents probably meant that the electorate was really also wanting to vote for independents, and you can definitely see that.
Yeah, interesting.
Just they split out so broadly that no independent got elected. The one that got closest was Sarah Blythe.
Right.
She didn't, you know, she's kind of almost didn't, you know, she almost got in, but it,
right. One thing that's pretty interesting about this election is that we had, you know, these parties that were socioeconomically left, like One City and COPE. But then we had this other element, which you mentioned in your blog post, which also was identified by the folks at the Canby Report, which is the, you know, urbanist, conservationist, or in this article you call it preservationist. So people who are into urban development, kind of using the free market to make housing more affordable, to build more transportation, public transportation, things like that, versus folks who want kind of neighborhoods to stay the same, less development, stuff like that. So I'm wondering, what did looking at this ballot data from the 2018 municipal election tell you about alliances between folks who are socioeconomically on the left but maybe positioned differently in terms of urbanist and preservationist views? Did it tell us anything about that?
Yeah, so it's a bit tricky. So a lot of the votes that people actually did, where they might have voted more preservationist, so more urbanist or more liberal conservative, I don't know how to score those, so I kind of just dropped these out. So it's really only preliminary view. But from that, it didn't really seem in people's voting behavior that the voters really had a strong urbanist, preservationist split. So if I look in terms of parties or examples, yes, Vancouver would be a party that would be on the conservative side of things when it comes to social issues, but more on the urbanist side of things when it comes to sort of the municipal development type of things, as opposed to Coalition Vancouver or the NPA, Coalition Vancouver, that would be more on the conservative side and more the preservationist side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And but we didn't really see that much clustering between people voting for some urbanist parties like One City that would be on the left,
mm-hmm.
but also Yes Vancouver, who would be urbanist but on the right. So there was not that much crossover. More grouping of the all political left parties together with COPE, which is probably, or the Greens, which are more preservationists. With One City, this was a very common combination. So I didn't really see that urbanist preservationist scale,
right,
and being a deciding factor in this election.
Right, and so also, like, yeah, you gave a good example. So yes, Vancouver is socially conservative but urbanist, and then One City is socially progressive but urbanist. So you didn't see a lot of people voting for them because they're both urbanists, like voting for them together. And then if we look at, say, the NPA and COPE, they're both preservationist, but one is socially progressive and one is socially conservative. And so we saw that play out, you know, in the recent vote on rapid transit on the subway line extending to UBC, how the NPA's Colleen Hardwick and COPE's Jean Swanson were the only two to vote against it. But you didn't see people voting for both COPE and the NPA.
That's right. So, I mean, I think the Jean Swanson NPA sort of vote, I haven't looked specifically, but it's probably, or in this case, have people voted for Swanson and for Hardwick on the same ballot? I think there'd be just a few if you look. But in terms of policy on some of these issues, they voted the same way on council, which is interesting. But it didn't seem to really play out in the election. It seemed to be more like a liberal-conservative type grouping on the ballots.
Yeah, which is so interesting in that this other divide, urbanist preservationist, it is really has been very telling already on council in the last 2 months that they've been in power. And yet it's not necessarily how voters, according to this ballot data, made their choices. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I'm wondering.
But again, I only have I only used part of the votes and treated the ones where I didn't have data on as sort of non-existent. So it would be interesting to deepen that analysis and really try to place also the independent candidates on that map and then try to see if something will come out.
Yes. I guess that would take a lot of time because you'd have to analyze each individual candidate
and
figure out their positions.
And ideally have several people score them so that it's sort of, to get a little bit of the bias out of it. And even within parties, right? So like we've seen the NPA, most councillors voted for the subway, whereas Hardwick voted against it. So it's not that the NPA votes as one block either.
Absolutely. That's a good point. And then also I'm wondering in terms of voting blocks and how voting blocks were attached to mayoral candidates. Was there anything that really stood out for you there?
I haven't looked in that in detail. So, but if I look in terms of sort of proximity, definitely Ken Sim was attached to NPA votes quite heavily. Kennedy Stewart and Shauna Sylvester were both attached more to the left-leaning spectrum. And it wasn't really clear to me what sort of the guides, what things were. I mean, there were some parties that voted a little bit more for one or the other that might have been leaning somewhat closer to one or another party that would have been leaning to either Shauna Sylvester or Kennedy Stewart. But it wasn't really anything that was very clear.
Right. And then from this data that was recently released, I know there hasn't been a lot of media coverage of it and its meaning. And you wrote in the beginning of your blog that, you were kind of hoping someone else would do some analysis on this, but in place of that, you've done some. I'm wondering, why do you think this data is important? Like, what do we learn from it that we didn't already know?
Well, it really tells us what I found interesting, too, is that really a lot of voters have a pretty broad spectrum of candidates they choose from. Some of it might be, they've maybe met a candidate or seen candidates before. And so there was a lot of mixing and matching, which I found quite interesting. And it just gives us more detail about, people's preferences. So I think it's great that the city has released it. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, actually, just as I pushed this out, I got a message from Chad Skelton, who's built an interactive on this, which, he was just, a couple hours or maybe half a day later than me till he was done with it, which is really quite beautiful, where you can play with it and play those games where you select one candidate and who else did these people vote for, which is really quite nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
So definitely worth checking out. And so other people have been doing stuff too. I've seen some things fly by where people also download the data. I mean, you can just put this in Excel and play with it. So it's fun.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Chad Skelton also has that interactive map or graph as well. And it would be interesting to compare this data with previous municipal elections.
So the by-election data is available too.
Okay.
Although there was only one candidate to be voted for, so it's probably not that interesting. Although there was, I think, school board votes too.
And previous
to
that,
I haven't looked at it yet. Previous to that, nothing's available, and I don't know if it will become available. At least this was something that Andrea Rima pushed for when she was in office, and that finally got released now. Which, I think it's great.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for your time. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for having me.
Okay, thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Hey, this is Steve Louie, photographing music waste in beautiful Vancouver, British Columbia, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Do you recognize the song playing in the background? plays every hour on the hour as part of our flagship station ID. If you do recognize this song, chances are less than 1 in 12 that you have donated to CITR. That means 11 out of 12 of our regular listeners are getting our content for free. So naturally, we called local businesses to see if we could get that kind of a deal. Here's how things went when we called Duffin's Donuts.
Hello, Duffin's Donuts.
Hi, I was wondering if I can get 12 pupusas, but just pay for one of them.
Like, do we owe you?
Owe you cinnamon rolls?
No, you don't owe me. I was just seeing if, like, that was a deal I could make.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Maybe in 20 years?
In 20 years?
Yeah. Is that okay?
Okay. I was hoping for it now, though. But
no, 20 years later.
20 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I'll try in 20 years.
You can show your support right now on your mobile device or computer by heading to citr.ca/donate or in person and over the phone during our annual fundraising week, February 28th to March 7th. Donate to keep CITR weird.
Hello, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Thanks for listening. We just heard an interview with Jens von Bergmann, where we explain some of the graphing and mapping that he's been doing of Vancouver's October municipal election. We're now going to go focus on some more timely news.
Yeah. Vancouver began a public hearing on a 90-unit mixed-use housing development and detox center. As we mentioned at the top of the show, this center is located on a block of land between Clark Drive and McLean Drive along First Avenue. So that's near like the East Van Cross sign, for example. It's generally an industrial area, although it's changing a bit now with developments like these, if it goes through. So of the mixed-use housing, that's rental units, and 50% of the rental units are set at current HIL rates, which means, for example, someone earning $41,000 a year would pay $900 a month for a studio. So they're, it's not cheap, but it's below market. Another example is a household with, $43,000 in income a year would pay, say, like $1,000 for a one-bedroom. Or a little more than that. So that's the sort of sense of what the HIL rates are. The other 50% of the rental units in this building will be at market rates. So they'll be, very expensive. A studio in a market rate in Vancouver is like, I don't know, I'm going to guess 1,800? I don't know. Quite a bit higher, probably double what the HIL rates are. So this development, it spans, a block of land. So it's a wide development. And at certain sections of it, it's set to be only 3 to 4 stories in height. But then there are other sections such as along Clark Drive, which is like a really busy industrial street. Then it's supposed to rise up to 10 stories. And on the section facing McLean Drive, it's supposed to be about 6 stories. So the height varies depending on where on the property you are. And so because so many people signed up to speak at this public hearing last night, the hearing was actually extended into today, and it began at 3 p.m. today. And I called City Hall to see if they had any sense of when it would end, and they didn't. And as far as I know, it's still going on as we speak. And according to the Vancouver Courier, more than 60 people signed up to speak last night. And last night, they only had time to hear 16 of them. Everyone gets at least 5 minutes to speak, and then counselors have questions, so it can take a really long time. Of those 16, 10 spoke in favor and 6 spoke against.
So despite the fact that the public hearing isn't over, we want to give you a sense of the different perspectives being voiced at City Hall. There are a mix of opinions. Some folks are in favor of keeping the project as it is. This includes the pro-housing group Abundant Housing, as well as the local political party One City, which Christine Boyle made clear she was not bound to at the beginning of the hearing. So other groups are against the project, including Stephen Boas of the Grandview Woodland Area Council, who says that the project goes against what the Grandview Woodland Area plan is.
Yeah, and just to clarify a little bit, because what I wrote in the script isn't super clear. So basically, like, One City is the party that Councillor Christine Boyle is part of. And so they actually tweeted before the public hearing that they, like, 100% support this project. So at the beginning of last night's public hearing, Christine spoke to the audience and the public and said, you know, just so you know, I'm not bound to that declaration by the party, and I'm open to what I hear tonight, because the whole idea of these public hearings is that counselors go in with an open mind and hear what people have to say and then make their decision. So she did make that clear. So in addition to the folks you listed, Lyndon, Stephen Boas of the Grandview Woodland area, we also spoke, myself and fellow reporter Binza spoke with Stephanie Langford of the VTU, as well as activists from the Carnegie Community Action Plan and VANDU, which is the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. And these, the Carnegie Community Action Plan folks and the VANDU folks, actually interrupted the public hearing, which was very unexpected. And they did so by holding up signs and dropping little origami tents from the top balcony of the City Hall chambers, and they fell down onto spectators and counselors below.
So let's explore this diversity of perspectives, beginning with Stephen Boas of the Grandview Woodland Area Council.
Do you mind telling us your name?
Yes, my name's Stephen Boas, B-O-H-U-S. That's my card. I live in Grandview Woodland. I'm in the notification area, but 7 blocks away. I'm a renter, and I actually don't support this rezoning.
Can you tell us why?
Well, the form of the development does not meet any of the policies in the Grandview Woodland plan, and I'm a renter, and I actually support 90 more units of housing. I'd love to see those units of housing, but putting them in an institutionally sized building over detox facilities, over a sobering center, it just doesn't fit. It's not a healthy environment for future residents.
So why is it not healthy more specifically?
Well, if you compare to what you could have like 4 to 6 story buildings, individual buildings with a connection to the ground, with courtyards. Like, these are places where people are going to grow up. They're going to stay here for years. And I don't believe that we should be warehousing people on the top floors of an institutional building. It just doesn't make sense.
And then I'm just wondering, does the actual detox and sobering center have anything to do with your resistance to the development?
Well, it's actually the size. So there are two existing facilities that they're looking at combining and making one gigantic one there. And in terms of sobering center, if correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe they forcibly keep people confined for up to 23 hours. And if that's true, that's incarceration. But, you know, we'll get a little bit of details if people are forcibly kept against their will. And if that's hundreds or a few thousand a year in that situation, I'm going to listen to the facts on that. But I think those uses aren't compatible. And in terms of what the Grandview Community Plan says, they say that if you want to rezone this property and give it more density and go up to 6 stories, then you have to build 100% housing. It's very clear on the plan for the lots that are comprising 80% of the property, the few lots along Clark or Arizona's industrial, and the city says they're not to be rezoned.
Well, where do you think a detox center should be built in Vancouver?
Well, we already have the two that exist at the locations that they want to combine, and I think city staff, well, they have claimed to do a large search all across the city. Freedom of information requests showed no responsive records from the City of Vancouver, and the same FOI from Vancouver Coastal Health only showed 2 sites, which was happened to be this one, and a very quick search for a site across the street that has yet to be built. So that was the extent of their search.
Who's doing these FOI requests?
There are members of the community that are sharing the FOIs around. It's just that the staff had claimed at the open house, I attended the open house, is that they had searched far and wide, that this conforms to the plan, and I read the plan, it does not. So there's a lot of misinformation out there. And I believe that they're trying to say that everything in Vancouver comes down to this one site. And I think that claim is ridiculous because they're trying to do too many things on this one site and it's going to fail on all counts. It's a fabulous site for more social housing, and I'm wondering why it's not 100% welfare rate. And why did they reduce the number of housing units from 97 units in the original proposal to 90? I think we should have the 97 units of social housing back, and I think people who are going to live in these units, they have to have either welfare rate or very low rental. And the way you do that is you build affordable housing and you build it in wood frame, which means you have to build it in 4 to 6 stories. And it's costs less to build and it's friendlier for the environment. So it's like a win-win-win. And I'm positive that we can find other locations for the detox, maybe even Grandview Woodland. And we can even have a small detox in Grandview Woodland, a community scale one, mm-hmm. not a detox for the entire city. And this is one of the things about having distributed services.
Right, yeah, so you're opposed to the way this structure is being built. It's too high, it's too condensed, as well as it doesn't fit with the Grandview Woodland plan, and we're centralizing all the detox resources into one space rather than spreading them out. Is that about right?
Well, that's about right, and you're also taking away detox resources from the community of Mount Pleasant and from the downtown east side, because those facilities would close if they're combined here, so you're actually taking it away from other parts of the city, so it's not a net gain.
Okay, all right, so that was Stephen Boas of the Grandview Woodland Area Council. So next, let's hear from Stephanie Langford of the Vancouver Tenants Union. So she highlights the 12 tenants who are currently on stand to be displaced if this development goes through.
I'm Stephanie Langford, and we're at City Hall on the third floor.
And are you here to speak to council tonight?
Yes, I'm here to speak to council tonight to talk about, it's the First and Clark development, but I'm here specifically on behalf of the Vancouver Tenants Union and as co-chair of the Outreach and Advocacy Team to talk about the tenants that are being displaced, and just to remind everyone here that while we support such an initiative, we're also concerned about the renters that are being displaced.
Okay, and you and Sarah have a piece of paper that kind of explains what you would like to see happen with the development. Is that correct? I haven't had a chance to read over it, but what does this say?
Well, it's really a challenge to the city to look at their relocation policy, because certainly the tenants that are being displaced tonight were mentioned earlier by the city and the development team, and they reference the relocation policy and various, you know, lingo of that policy and what they're offering the tenants. We're just making sure that the renters that the city currently has can be temporarily relocated and returned to their neighborhood, potentially to the block where they've been living, some for up to 30 years, and that their tenure is honored, and that the rent and the space that they have currently will be honored. So that's really what this is about for us.
And with the redevelopment plan, it includes the right of first refusal to the tenants who are being dislocated, as well as like assistance with moving. But is that adequate? What you're saying is you'd like more, and could you say what you would like specifically?
Yeah, well, this is a test of just how ethical the city is as a landlord, and because the relocation policy is kind of vague in certain areas, and I think it's as advocates for the renters, and these renters are exemplars of how the policy is used. You know, the city will speak about the policy with other developers that buy up rental units, but they're, in this case, they're the landlord, and how are they going to honor the policy, but also how does it fit for these renters? You're right that, you know, right of first refusal has been mentioned, but the suggestion is that their current renters of the city that are being displaced will have to disclose their finances to be able to qualify to come back into the block where they've been living for decades, and that there's some question about exactly what would that rent be. And of course, I'm going to argue that they, you know, that the city as the landlord for these renters honor the tenure, current tenancy of these renters, that they be temporarily relocated in the same space in rent, and then they come back at that same, you know, obviously if it's a couple of years where they're temporarily relocated, that, you know, the rent goes up according to the annual increase of the RTA. And but what the city's sort of been doing with some of the one-on-one meetings and meetings with the tenants as a group is that well, each person is individual, and we have to sort it out individually with them, and we find out how much you make, and suddenly the conditions of their tenancy are changing.
Right, so because they get right of first refusal, and if they qualify for the social housing, then they would get access to that, but that's at HDMI cutoffs, which is like 900 or 800 a unit, so it's well below what would be a social welfare rate. So basically the tenants, some of whom have been there for 30 years plus, will be paying more rent. So you're arguing that they'll get to keep paying what they're paying now.
Yes, exactly. That I can appreciate the conditions that the city and in collaboration with BC Housing are trying to negotiate and set up. And I, you know, of course, we are looking for more social housing and affordable housing in the city. So, you know, I would certainly support that. However, I'm talking about displaced renters that have current, you know, tenancy with the city, and that how they qualify is different from what the general qualifications are for the tenants that then move into this social housing, you know, building tower. And so they are exemplars for how the city treats their current tenants.
So that was, again, Stephanie Langford of the Vancouver Tenants Union. And so, yeah, I mean, I spoke with her and you just heard what she said, and I mean, so it's a bit more complex than meets the eye. There are tenants currently living on the property, and although they are given right of first refusal, meaning they have sort of first dibs on living in the new rental units that are constructed, in order to get to be part of the 50% of the rental units that are available at Hill rates, which we went over earlier in the show, is, you know, if you make $40,000, it's like $900 for one studio. It depends on your income. And in this application, that rate, like that housing, is referred to as social housing, which was brought up. There's so many interesting terms in Vancouver for like social housing, what is affordable, that are just like so arbitrary. It's honestly, it's funny. What is, like, we have, in contrast with this quote-unquote social housing, we have social welfare rate housing, which is not set to be built in this housing project. That is, like, at welfare rate. So that's, like, $375 a month. So that is very different than this social housing, which is at Hill rates, which is hundreds and hundreds of dollars more than that. So anyway, key to note that. So although these folks who are living on the property now will have right of first return to the new rental units, they will almost definitely be paying more than what they're paying now, because as Stephanie told me, some of them have been there for like 30 years. So they're paying, you know, pretty affordable rent. Also in the interview, I said, I think I said HDL rental rate. I meant Hill rental rate. And also I said well below, when I meant well above, like they'll be paying well above what they're paying now. Just minor corrections. Anyway.
Okay. So next we're going to hear from Summit Huja from the Live Big Society, a nonprofit focused on helping people access rehabilitation treatment in BC. So he talks about in support of the proposed detox center and how it benefits from offering more treatment, and also kind of the continuity of treatment that actually it provides to the people who would go there.
All right, let's take a listen to that.
Sadhu and Rob Rye. We're from the Live Big Society. We are a not-for-profit organization that raises funds to help people attend treatment centers in BC. We're here in support of the proposed development from the perspective of the withdrawal management center that's being proposed. We deal with people who are looking to attend treatment centers, and the cost of a treatment center privately funded is between $18,000 to $30,000 per person for approximately 52 days. When we try to send people to public centers, there's a significant backlog and very difficult to get people in. When we're dealing with a person who's interested in going to treatment, that 4-week to 5-week wait is critical. And it's just a systemic problem that we have. And this proposed development, at least in our opinion, from what we've been told and what we've seen so far, has been it's needed, mm-hmm. and it gives hope. We come from the professional perspective. I'm a lawyer here in BC. I'm also a recovering alcoholic and addict. And I myself have seen how difficult addiction can be for a person and a family. And I'm thankful to have been able to go to treatment. And I'm a person in long-term recovery now. And I've seen these two gentlemen walk through things that they've walked through, and they'll tell you about it themselves. But centers like this need to happen because addiction is a disease. We're not good people, or we're not bad people trying to get good. We're sick people trying to get well.
Well, how much does it cost right now for someone to go to a detox center? Like you're saying, this is going to be subsidized by Vancouver Coastal Health.
Yes.
So what is the cost comparison?
Well, there's private and public detox centers. Private centers are expensive, and it depends on the duration of the stay. I'll give you an example of a center in White Rock that's approximately $950 per day, ranging of cost between, say, $500 to $950 per day in some of the centers that we're working with. The delay and the wait that you have getting into a publicly funded detox, that's the problem that I referred to earlier. Frankly, people wanting to detox have to wait to get in, and then you're stuck sometimes staying on the street. Then you get back into the vicious cycle of the addiction, which makes it even worse and harder to want to come back to a detox.
But, so there are public detox centers that are free?
Yes.
Once you just have to wait. There's like a list, right?
Precisely.
Okay.
There's a list, and then there's procedures that you have to follow to get in.
Okay.
And it's difficult. And given the demand of them, they're very difficult and can be very difficult to get into if you're looking to get into one.
Do you think there's any sort of particular benefit with combining a detox center with social housing and social enterprise spaces?
I do, from the perspective of the detox center leading into the next phase, which would be sobriety from our perspective, and then leading back into society in general. So I see it as a sort of a build-up to a person re-entering society and becoming a productive person in general. So I think the link between them is the key, because you get a person from detox into social housing, hopefully, and then from there moving them out into different housing and helping people move forward with their lives. So the center and the continuity, I think, is very important.
And currently, how well of a job do you think the city's doing of handling this addiction crisis?
It's difficult to look at specifics. I think more centers need to be open. I think more funding needs to be provided, without a doubt, to assist people, and then more education and awareness around the, frankly, the stigma piece that we talked about, and then helping people gain information and awareness about what recovery is and the benefits of it. I'll give you the example of shows on TV that deal with addiction. You spend 97% showcasing the problem and 3% showcasing the solution. Let's reverse that. Show the solution, show how people can change their lives and turn it around. I got two gentlemen here with me that have completely changed their lives. I've been the benefactor of a beautiful life through recovery and sobriety. So I think we've got to concentrate more on the positive rather than the negative.
Do you know if there's a benefit to having multiple detox centers in the city versus like one centralized one? Is that better or worse? Do you have some?
For myself, I'm actually from Alberta, and I left Alberta and actually came to BC in order to actually get into a detox center and into a treatment center. And Alberta itself, I can only speak for them, but it's a very limited amount. And even coming to BC, I couldn't get in right away. And money was actually not an issue at that point. And you still run into the same problems. So you can only imagine what a person with limited funds has to deal with, right?
But is it beneficial to have like many, like as in like smaller detox centers that maybe admit like 10 or 15 people versus like this larger one, which I think has 51 beds?
I guess it all depends on which way you look at it. So we're dealing with a volume crisis in BC with the opioid crisis as it is, right? So I think the more beds that you have available, whether it be in smaller stations like 10 to 12 beds or even one massive center with 50, the more people you can get into detox, the more help you're going
to
be.
To me, I think that's important. When you have the separate detox, what's the next step? And I know that there's a detox fairly close by to the proposed development, which is fantastic, and they do incredible work. I've seen it, I've been in there, and I've got a chance to see the great work they do. But it's difficult because what is the next step? Here, I like the plan because of the continuity of care.
All right. So that was my colleague, co-reporter Binza, and myself interviewing some folks who are pro-detox. They're very in favor of this detox center, specifically that component of the development rather than the housing so much. And as they mentioned, they are recovering alcoholics. And so one element of this they really liked was that there is, you know, a detox center, but also a sobering center, all in this one space, as well as housing. And so that was something that they saw as a really, like, a big positive. So, like, just to put this in perspective, to step back for a minute, when I was at City Hall yesterday, I would say most of the conversations I had with folks were focused on affordability, and that was kind of the most kind of like talked about issue in this development. So most folks were saying that, you know, basically it's great that we have more rental stock, but it needs to be more affordable. Like the HIL rates, the HIL rates are too high, and the other half, that's 50% of the rental stock in this development, and the other half are market rates. So it's like, it's not affordable. But a huge part of this conversation that is also important is the whole, like, the whole, everything that was just said by the folks that were interviewed. And yeah, so, like, we just wanted to talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, so, like, talking about that component of the story, like, the stigma against a lot of people who are recovering from addiction, you know, as from what we've seen from a lot of the opposition, both in the letters and a lot of people talking, I think there's a lot, you can kind of see kind of just being a little bit of ignorance and misinformation regarding what this place actually would be. A lot of them reference, oh, it's unwise to mix people who are actively using with people trying to recover, which doesn't really make any sense, because as soon as you go through the detox, you cannot, you should not do any of drugs or whatever you're addicted to.
Yeah, I mean, so basically, Lyndon, you're referencing, the city actually is very transparent in a lot of ways. They've posted letters that people have sent to them both for and against the center, right? So you've been reading through some of the letters that are opposed, and we should give the caveat that most letters that have been sent in the city have been in favor of the project. So this is, there are less people not in favor, but yeah, what are some of the things people are saying, you were mentioning.
Yeah, so a lot of people were worried about the crime. Right. Or like, oh, this is a safe neighborhood for families. Yeah. And just kind of just not very informed of what an actual place like this, how it would operate, because it's actually very enclosed. I don't think they're allowed to leave or whatever. So I just think that a lot of this kind of stems from that lack of awareness that I think was mentioned in the interview.
Yeah, totally. It's interesting because there's an article that came out yesterday. I forget who published it, but it was on a temporary modular housing development that happened in Marple, which the News Collective reported on and actually won an award for at the Community and Campus Radio Awards last year. And this temporary modular housing building, which is for folks who are like homeless and some who are still entrenched in drug addiction. So there was a lot of opposition to this because in particular, the building was near an elementary school. So we reported, Ryan Patrick Jones and Christina Song went to the site and reported on it and talked to folks. And they were like, we're not NIMBY, we're SIMBY or something. It was like, not in my schoolyard, NIMCY.
Okay.
So they're like, oh no, but there's kids, this is dangerous. So anyway, this article came out yesterday that basically said there have been no like concerns with that temporary modular housing unit. There have been no harm, no danger has come to the elementary school that's nearby. And actually a lot of the people, or some of the folks who found housing in the temporary modular housing, have been enrolled in like educational programs and have like started to move, you know, away from being homeless and kind of, to, for lack of a better phrase, get their lives back on track
So, and although they did mention as well, a few folks had passed away who moved into the temporary modular housing because they were in really poor health, which is really sad. But anyway, so stigma is profoundly dangerous. And yeah, some people are voicing that over this project. So anyway, the last thing that I'd like to share from this public hearing yesterday, we'll go to after just a really quick break, but please stay tuned because there was an kind of exciting incident where unexpectedly some folks disrupted the public hearing. So we're going to hear what happened there after a short break. Please stay tuned.
I would love it if you would take a big sip of that good juice, the water that you get from the taps, the springs. Also, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you. I'm Shitlord Fuckerman. Don't swear.
Do you recognize the song playing in the background?
Hi, this is Shitlord Fuckerman. I would love it if you would take a big sip of water
that you get. Do you recognize the song playing in the background? Plays every hour on the hour as part of our flagship station ID. If you do recognize this song, chances are less than 1 in 12 that you have donated to CITR. That means 11 out of 12 of our regular listeners are getting our content for free. So naturally, we called local businesses to see if we could get that kind of a deal. Here's how things went when we called Duffin's Donuts.
Hello, Duffin's Donuts.
Hi, I was wondering if I can get 12 pupusas, but just pay for one of them.
Like, do we owe you?
Owe you cinnamon rolls?
No, you don't owe me. Just, I was just seeing if, like, that was a deal I could make.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Maybe in 20 years?
In 20 years?
Yeah. Is that okay?
Okay. I was hoping for it now, years. Though. But
no, 20 years later.
20 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I'll try in 20 years.
You can show your support right now on your mobile device or computer by heading to citr.ca/donate or in person and over the phone during our annual fundraising week, February 28th to March 7th. Donate to keep CITR weird.
All right. And we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Sorry for playing that same fund drive ad twice, but it's pretty funny, right? That's me. I called Duffin's Donuts. Also, apologies for the technical issues at the beginning of the show. There were some volume problems, but anyway, we're smooth sailing from here on. We want to end today's news show with an interview that myself and fellow reporter Binza did with some of the activists from Carnegie Community Action Plan and Van Du, who interrupted last night's public hearing on the redevelopment at Clark and First. So basically, you'll hear actually some tape from the interruption itself, but they were protesting against this development, and the reason was because not enough shelter has been made available for people who are experiencing homelessness, and there's not enough affordable housing in the city. So they saw this as another project that wasn't actually addressing those most in need. And the signs they held up said, shelter rate housing now, and 50 tents too many, referring to the fact that there are 50 tents in Oppenheimer Park currently, according to one of the activists who counts them every night, she said. And these are folks living, there's one to two people usually in the tents, living and freezing in the freezing cold in East Van. So let's go to this interview and hear what these people have to say.
If you didn't throw things on people, that would be great. And, you know, thanks for voicing that. So again, throwing stuff on people below is not too cool. No, you made your point. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yesterday, which was Wednesday, February 20th, around 7:30 p.m., 50 origami tents dropped from the top balcony of City Hall chambers and fell down onto staff and spectators. and counselors below. The paper tents were dropped right as the public hearing portion of the night was about to begin. The topic of the public hearing was a redevelopment at Clark and First Avenue in East Van. And this redevelopment project is a large one. It includes mixed rate rental units. So some units being rented below BC housing income levels and some being rented at private rental market rates. We tracked down the activists who dropped these paper tents and spoke with them about what they were doing at City Hall and why they decided to interrupt the public hearing.
Hi, my name is Ellie Taylor, and I'm working with the CCAP project, Carnegie Community Action Project, and this is my supervisor.
My name's Fiona York. I'm with the Carnegie Community Action Project, and I'm also with the Our Homes Can't Wait Coalition.
Hi, I'm Flora. I'm from Van Du. I work at Van Du, but I'm also on the, for Our Homes Can't Wait. Been fighting this for like, well, it's 10 years now going, but I got in like, I think, nearly 3 years ago now.
So are you for or against this project?
I think our official stance is that we support the idea of the project as long as it actually incorporates downtown Eastside residents, provides proper housing for them afterwards, and allows shelter-rate housing in the building. I mean, it's ridiculous to ask someone who's receiving only $375 a month for shelter to pay $800, even on a low-end Hills. This idea that this is social housing is atrocious. True social housing would have equity, and it would be self, you know what I mean? The funders would fund it, but instead, this development.
Can I ask you to describe what just happened in City Hall for our listeners?
Well, for me anyway, I was just sitting there just getting pissed off because I'm just like, isn't this what we've been saying for the past how many years? With 58 West Hastings to, like, you know, have it 100%?
So to be honest, CCAP is speaking in support of the proposed motion for the facility at First and Clark, but it's kind of a nuanced support because we do want to have more shelter rate housing that's then provided, because you talk about social rate housing that's really not social housing and it's not affordable. It's got this kind of like skewed definition based on the bylaws. Mm-hmm. So we would want to see more shelter rate housing that's really affordable. We did send a letter in support of the motion, but stating that and also talking about centralization is not always a good thing. We sometimes things need to be accessible in neighborhoods where people have their social supports as well. But what all of us work on, all of our groups, Van Du, Our Homes Can't Wait, and CCAP, is shelter rate housing in the downtown east side. So one of the big things we've been working on is 58 West Hastings and trying to push for 100% shelter rate housing. That's been a 10-year movement, as Flora was saying, that we've been working on with like tent cities and squats and actions and petitions and lots of support from residents in the downtown east side to make that new building all 100% shelter and pension rate housing. But what we came here tonight to do was to draw attention to the tents in Hoppenheimer Park. Mm-hmm. It's all related to housing. There's a lack of affordable shelter rate housing, a huge lack. It's a major gap and people are falling through the cracks. So right now, this is the first winter that Vancouver has ever seen people tenting. 80 to 100 per night, 50 tents, two to three people per tent. So 80 to 100 people sleeping in the snow in Hoppenheimer Park because there's a lack of housing. So it's a new low for Vancouver. It's never, from what I've heard from activists, housing activists, there's never been a tent city in the winter.
In the winter.
In the snow, in freezing temperatures before, and this has gone on for months. We've been calling every level of government. Everyone. We've been asking BC Housing, Parks Board, City
Red
Staff,
Cross.
Red Cross, partner organizations, BC Housing, every city councillor several times, the mayor. We had a meeting with the mayor. And we've been told things like the city staff don't like warming tents, or there's a warming shelter down the street, and there's many, many reasons people don't want to use that. So we're trying to call attention. What we did was we had signs talking about 50 tents in Oppenheimer Park. 50 tents is too many. We dropped 50 origami tents over the railing, so we wanted to draw attention to that. And it's all linked to housing, so it all comes together with this proposal where they're not providing affordable housing, and we want to have 100% affordable housing at 58 West Hastings.
And I just want to add that it's an epidemic all over Vancouver. There's 2,200 people up that are homeless. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a downtown Eastside issue. This is going to span out everywhere, and people are dealing with this, and we know that. But the point is, these are vulnerable people, people that have had hard lives, no protection. There's no even light there at night. And so we really need to work to give them the respect they deserve as human beings. I mean, it seems like so many projects make use of them to make money, and yet the truth of it is they're just the same as you and me. We bleed the same, we feel the same, we love the same, we desire the same. And the average life expectancy in the DTS is 45 years.
Mm-hmm. What about all the like temporary modular housing being built? Do folks have access to that?
Well, there's nothing that's available right now for the people in Oppenheimer Park. And the other thing that the city keeps responding, and everyone that we speak to is saying, even the Red Cross is saying, well, there's a warming center, there's a shelter, there's something down the street, but it's so problematic. Housing, of course, there's waiting lists, there's intake, there's, you know, supportive housing, so some of it's 10-year waiting list, so there's no guarantee that people can get right away. And with warming centers and shelters, they're usually full. Warming centers are not necessarily accessible for people who have pets or partners or belongings. Mm-hmm. What people told me last night when I was in the park, I've been going every night to count the number of tents and people that are there. So people last night were saying if you disappear, your stuff disappears. If you go, your stuff goes. So they can't go to a warming center for a few hours. They don't have beds in there. They're crowded. They're stressful. Mm-hmm. People would rather stay with their stuff and their partners and their pets and their belongings in the park, even though it's freezing cold and major health conditions. There's rats there. It's been below freezing for weeks and weeks. But the warming centers are not necessarily an option. So that's the response that we keep getting from every group that we've spoken to.
And the thing too is, it's like before winter came, like they were getting forced out at 7 o'clock in the morning if you weren't ready.
Yep.
They take all your stuff, everything that they owned or wanted to keep to themselves, get taken and thrown in the garbage.
Yeah.
And we keep, we keep telling the workers, is that, like, what would you do if somebody went and did that to your place? Just taking stuff out of there and just threw it in the garbage, even though the personal items that you've wanted to keep for a long time, like keepsakes and that, and they just throw them in the garbage.
ID. People have had their ID thrown out, and that's hugely problematic, of course. Like, it's a major endeavor to replace your ID, and people have had their ID thrown out. So we've also been trying to push for not having the monthly rates, not having the cleanups or the check-ins every morning, and having people's stuff thrown out. And we've heard even if people want to go to the hospital, they may not be able to do that because they don't want to leave their tents, and city staff or city crews might pick it up and get rid of it. So there's not really very many options. And now, you know, this is what we're seeing, is there's 100 people sleeping in the snow in Oppenheimer Park, and it's never happened before. So what's going on? We're just seeing this like real crisis of affordability and lack of housing in the downtown Eastside. And I wanted to add that I actually think people in the downtown Eastside are way more informed than many other people are, like really well educated, really know their rights, they know things about housing, and that I, because of lived experience and just being, you know, very resilient, and a lot of activists and people in the community that will know better than many outside the community what shelter rate housing is or what affordable housing is. We're hearing here, like, the counselors are debating what does affordable mean, people who have the lived experience know what affordable housing mean and social housing.
That being true, at the same token, you'd think that they would take us seriously then and give us some room and do what they need to do. But for some reason, even though we're just as educated, even more so, organized, we're still up against.
What pondered my mind was like trying to figure out who said it would get ghettoized. Yeah. And I'm like, we're going with like the Chinese people. Like, you're going to see these old Chinese people and old Indian people going out there to turf war against these members or something. Like, come on. Like, what we're looking, they figure we're looking at trying to house addicts, drug dealers. We're trying to house like the Chinese people, that them too, because their rents are getting high. And then along with the people downtown, and then and plus having like, you know, reunifying the mothers back with their kids because they can't afford a place, so they can't get their kids. This way it's affordable for them and they can get their kids back. Yeah. They can work their way through or whatever they need to do. Like, you know, it's like like, who knows, like 10 years from now, they could, like, you know, find a great job or do something and just might want to move on.
Are you saying that because of Vancouver's housing crisis, families are being separated?
Yes. Yeah. Holy smokes, that's
ministry is...
It's another source of... residential school. But the kids that they're taking, the kids, tearing the kids away from their parents, especially their moms, and putting them in non-Aboriginal homes. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't know the difference between, like, because Aboriginal people are close with their kids. They hug them, they're close to them, and they don't, like, you know, put them at a distance or anything, and then they go stay somewhere, and how are they supposed to be? Like, probably cry a lot, and they're being told to be quiet. Like, not acceptable.
Yep, and to add to that, the ministry won't allow you to have your kids in a lot of places, and also the places won't. So if, so in order to make a choice to have housing, as some people having have to choose to give up their kids, and this is an atrocity. She's right, 100%.
Okay, so that was just another perspective on this project, and that wraps up our reporting of last night's public hearing on redevelopment, which is still happening now, on the project at Clark and First Avenue. Because so many people came to speak, the hearing has now been extended today. Yep, and just gone on to recess. So you can head down to City Hall and listen, or stream live on the city's website. And the hearing began at 3 p.m., and we're still not sure when it's going to end and whether or not they're actually going to vote on it today.
Yeah, lots of speakers. I don't think they're voting today, but yeah. Thanks so much for listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alex DeBoer.
And I'm Lyndon Wong.
We've been your hosts for today. Tune in again next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more local undercovered news. Also, please like the CITR News Collective on Facebook and Twitter. And I implore you to subscribe to our truly awesome podcast, Seeking Office. Get it wherever you get your podcasts from. So thanks again, and stay tuned for more awesome CITR programming coming up. Thanks again.